WLFE TV Radio.
Are you ready?
Live from the Metal Mayhem Studios in Rochester, New York.
We are gold.
And heard around the world by metalheads just like you. This is Metal Mayhem ROC.
Heavy metal music.
Your weekly dose of metal music, interviews, album reviews, news, and more.
Want to be part of the show?
Send us a message through our website,
MetalMayhemROC.com.
Or hit us up on Facebook and Twitter.
Search Metal Mayhem ROC.
It's getting nice and heavy.
And now, welcome tonight's host, John the Vernomatic Verno.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this week's show. As always, Thursday nights, new content drops. Visit the MetalMayhemROC.com website. There you'll find direct links to Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, however you consume your content. Download some past shows at the website. Subscribe to the podcast. That kind of stuff helps in all our analytics and stuff. Sign up for our email list. There you'll receive weekly updates on new shows, merch promos, and free giveaways. Tonight, we're continuing our riveting History of Metal series, the year 1976. Again, Metal Walt and Ian O'Rourke, two members of the Metal Mayhem ROC team. They're here to continue our discussion. 1976 saw new releases by Kiss, a couple new releases, Rush, a couple new releases, Thin Lizzy, Judas Priest, Queen, AC/DC. So what we're going to do, we're going to explore all of these bands, all of these releases. I mixed in some music, a little snapshot of some of these bands, some new releases, this year's debut albums, Boston, Yesterday and Today, which eventually turned into Y&T. The Runaways, Ramones, Crocus, the landscape in the metal and hard rock world was just really getting busy. It's a jam-packed episode, and we invite you to enjoy it. It's entertaining, it's educational, and hey, you know, there's even some tunes in it. I just want to remind you, on Monday nights, I host the radio version of the show. It's Metal Mayhem ROC Live. It's on thatmetalstation.com. It's 3 hours of live interactive metal. There's a chat room there. You correspond with myself along with some of the other people around the world that are listening to the show. It's a real good time. So it's a great way to bring your Metal Monday in for a landing. So let's get things started. Live from New Jersey, Metal Walt. Hey, Walt, how you doing, man?
I'm great, Verno. How are you?
Good, good. So why don't you get us started tonight? You got a recap of what we covered in 75 and what's ahead for 76.
Absolutely. So I think in 75 leading into 76, there was, again, a common theme of several things. I think we saw, again, a lot of the big hitters putting out releases in 75 that continued to 76. But it was also, let's say, the beginning of the decline of some of the bigger bands, such as Black Sabbath and Alice Cooper, let's say, in the quality of the releases, and the beginning of the demise for Deep Purple. Also, you saw between 75 and 76 that upward trend of bands now releasing live albums as part of their regular repertoire. And I think in 76, you see even more of that coming. And I think, again, there was some changes between 75 and 76. Things that come to mind would be, let's say, Sammy Hagar leaving Montrose. And unfortunately, the breakup, or let's say the demise of Deep Purple, also after that was the death of their guitar player, Tommy Bolin. So yeah, that was sort of the start of where we got into 76.
Let's welcome back our other metal historian, Ian O'Rourke. Hey, Ian, welcome back. How you doing, buddy?
Vernomatic, it is good to be here again. I am excited about 1976. It's one of my favorite years in hard rock and heavy metal.
Really? Why is it one of your favorite years?
Well, I'm not going to divulge all of the bands that are coming up, but just a few of the bands that we will be discussing. Judas Priest, Thin Lizzy, Scorpions, UFO, Queen. I mean, that's just that little handful there. really put out just some great albums, particularly with Judas Priest. You know, this was the release of Sad Wings of Destiny. Sad Wings of Destiny is pound for pound probably that album, aside from Rainbow Rising, that Walt just said, that can be, you can see now this is heavy metal going forward. Black Sabbath and Zeppelin and Purple, and they, you know, they may have been the founding fathers, but what they were doing was still very rooted in the blues, heavy rock. Yeah, the word metal was being thrown around, but by the time you've got Judas Priest coming around with Victim of Changes, The Ripper, Dreamer Deceiver, Deceiver, then you've got Prelude and The Tyrant, you've got Genocide, you've got Epitaph and Island of Domination. This is from beginning to end just solid slab of early metal. It's just a great album.
I agree with that. Sad Wings, you know, even though I like a lot of those songs, the live version better, but you're spot on. It was a great sophomore effort. You know, we were starting to find their way into the, it was pre, you know, Denim and Studs, but you're right. It was the heavier stuff. What else you got? Whatever, what else was coming around in 76?
So Thin Lizzy drops not only one monumental album, but two. In the same year, they start off the early part of the year with the album Jailbreak. You can't turn on the radio without hearing the song Jailbreak or The Boys Are Back in Town. And they both came off this album later in the year with the album Johnny the Fox, with songs like Johnny, with Rocky, Borderline. You've got Johnny the Fox Meets Jimmy the Weed. You've got Massacre. I mean, all of the songs, or a majority of the songs on these two albums, are what would be played live going forward. Matter of fact, when we finally get a chance to touch on it, the seminal Live and Dangerous album that's going to be coming down the road, the majority of the material comes from these two albums that's on that album.
Cool, cool. Well, you know, honestly, I like my hard rock and metal American style. You know, those Euro bands, and much respect to them. But 76 saw Aerosmith, and you saw Rocks. Now, you know, Rocks ranked 366 on Rolling Stone's top 500 greatest albums of all time. Just the list of the songs on that just go on and on. Back in the Saddle, Rats in the Cellar, Licking a Promise. It's just fantastic. Aerosmith, at that point, they would become, you know, America's equivalent of the Stones, if you will. Steven Tyler, Joe Perry, Brad Whitford, you know, original band, Joey Kramer, Tommy Hamilton. They're, in my eyes, is American royalty. Walt, what's your take on Aerosmith?
Yeah, I mean, Aerosmith in 76, I mean, they were just big, humongous. And it was really, like you said, the start of, let's say, stardom of American hard rock, bluesy-based bands. And I think you couldn't get top higher than Aerosmith at that point in time. I think they were right there on the top of the mountain along with Kiss. I think in 76, you saw Kiss release two albums, but this was the continuation of their trend upwards. And, you know, they released, you know, Destroyer, which was really another one of its times where you saw different variety of songs on the album. And it was really their first from a change of that raw sound into things that had orchestration and ballads. But I mean, just to think of one album that you know, out of it comes Detroit Rock City, Beth, King of the Nighttime World, God of Thunder, Shatter Out Loud, and Do You Love Me? I mean, oh my God, right? It was also the start of their relationship for their career with Bob Ezrin producing it. And then they released later in the year Rock and Roll Over, which is, you know, very highly underrated album. It was just, you know, kind of just had a really good, underrated, a lot of deep tracks on that album, and just a good songs on there, such as I Want You and Calling Dr. Love, Making Love, Hard Luck Woman. And it was just showed the consistency of their album style. So I think they were right up there with Aerosmith in 76 on, you know, top of the shelf.
Oh, I agree. And Destroyer, circling back on that, it's been noted that Ezrin just pushed those guys. And if he didn't like it, he wasn't intimidated by those guys and the immense fame that they've received since blowing up on Kiss Alive 1. Yeah, I love those two albums. Destroyer, Rock and Roll Over. Ian, what's your take? You a fan of that mid-Kiss stuff?
Well, I mean, this is why I didn't. I only said what I was going to mention, because I could have gone through every name that we've gone through so far. The salivation that I have going on for this conversation, and when you guys are mentioning this, some of my favorite stuff. Rocks, oh my God, Rocks is such a fantastic album. And then Destroyer and Rock and Roll Over. This is that pinnacle point for both of these bands, really, when it comes to not only their popularity, but some of the quality material that they're putting out. You know, that 75 into 76 going into 77, really, really great stuff. Same with the Scorpions. You know, this is another band that we talked about before, and they finally started to get a little bit more of their niche going. They were starting to spread their wings and start to really hone in on that hard rock, heavy metal sound that was coming around. You know, they've got great songs, you know, like Backstage Queen, Virgin Killer, that came out on this album. You know, but I mean, starting off the album with like Pictured Life, it's just really great stuff. Hellcat, Crying Days, Polar Nights. I mean, this is all just great, great material. And all these songs, you know, would end up making their way onto another fine live album that's going to be coming down the road, to Tokyo Tapes, by this band. So, yeah, really, really good stuff all the way around.
Oh, yeah, the Scorpions, like I mentioned before, they just ascended like Priest did. Just these leaps and bounds they took every album. Fantastic. Now, like Kiss, Rush was in a situation where their next album, they're on thin ice. And so in 76, they pushed all the chips in and they released what some consider the greatest concept album ever in 2112. Released in April 1st, 1976, the whole side one was a concept album, all seven parts of it. And I absolutely love this album. Every bit of that first side is fantastic. One of my favorite Rush albums, and I'm a big Rush fan. I love it all. Side one was the concept, but side two, they're demonstrating that they could still write some of those more conventional 4 to 5 minute songs. A Passage to Bangkok was fantastic. The Twilight Zone, you know, Neil as the lyricist, just absolutely infatuated with sci-fi. Alex Lifeson even got into some writing and did the song Lessons. Something for Nothing was a live staple during that set. So, well, what's your take on 2112?
Oh, yeah. 2112, at least the theme of 2112 is amazing. And I think it was another one that was far ahead of its time for 76. Just the storyline behind the guitar. And I think it's a great testament to the band really going in that next direction of these proggy, longer type songs, but that have a really harder edge, and ones that really stood out over the next, you know, bunch of decades in terms of the music. And I think it also lended itself to the perfect time for them to release a live album. And this was something I touched on earlier about that trend upwards on live albums in 76. So you followed up with All the World's a Stage, which was essentially capturing that live element of the 2112 album with, let's say, all of their, let's say, really select choices from the early repertoire years of, you know, 74 through early 76.
All right, would you please welcome home Rush!
Later on in their career, they would release several more live albums, I think maybe three or four more. It also, you saw more of this coming. I mean, you had Led Zeppelin release The Song Remains the Same this year, which again is like another standout legendary album in the live category from this period. Another one to point out that, let's call it, it's not in the metal community, but it's in the, let's say, honorable mention, as we call it, would be Frampton Comes Alive, which, again, I think you could imagine an 18-year-old boy's bedroom in 1976, and they would have posters up on their wall, and probably the first two would have been Kiss and Aerosmith, and the third one would have been Peter Frampton. And he's just a magnificent guitar player in his own right, but it just showed the power of those live albums and what they meant to the artists and the fans, and how it really set the industry forward from that point on.
Oh, I totally agree. You know, like you said, it's not necessarily metal, but that was the grand poobah of live albums. That he made a career on that. Geddy Lee talked about that in an interview with a Canadian publication back when that came out, talking about that the reason they did that was to buy themselves a little more time to prepare the follow-up album. It was a chance for them to close the chapter on that first section of their career and to buy some time to move forward. So another band that was double dipping two albums in 1 year was AC/DC. So 76 saw High Voltage. Now in the last episode we touched on this. Basically, High Voltage is the American release of their 75 album TNT, which was just released in Australia. All but two songs are the same, but then the other album they had was Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap. Now, I don't know how familiar you guys are with this, like the beginning career of AC/DC, but it's really weird because they have all these albums. They're only released over, like, in Australia and other places. And, you know, like, Dirty Deeds, it was from 75, but it wasn't released in America until 81. So it wasn't really like these albums are coming out, but they're not really released worldwide. Dirty Deeds, fantastic album. Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap. There's going to be some rockin'. Problem Child's originally on here, but then, you know, I think it was on the Let There Be Rock album later on. Squealer, Big Balls, Jailbreak. And then, you know, Jailbreak was recorded back then, but then came out on a, you know, Jailbreak 74. It's all over the place. But the bottom line, this was the beginning of AC/DC. They're releasing these albums, and it really started a career that, honestly, one of the biggest bands in the history of rock and roll and metal.
There was a friend of mine on murder, and the judge's gavel fell. Jury found him guilty, gave him 16 years in hell.
Angus says they're rock and roll, they're not metal. And earlier in their career, when they were being booked in their first English UK tour, the promoter thought they were punks, like a punk band. So put them on all these bills with all these punk bands. And it's funny because I was reading up on this and Angus was saying, yeah, we're up there playing and they're spitting at us, but we didn't fucking care. We turned around and spit back at them and we sort of won them over. And so it sort of helped their career in a strange way. Walt, any input on AC/DC? What's your knowledge of them and your view on the AC/DC guys?
Yeah, so AC/DC in 76, right? I mean, I don't know if they were, let's say, a household name, especially here in the States. I mean, I think this is a band that, you know, probably hit that prominence, you know, around that Back in Black album, and that became when they were most recognizable, let's say, to that American audience. And it's pretty amazing because, right, let's say most Americans might say they didn't even really realize the whole Bon Scott era was happening, you know, prior to that. I mean, it's not to say it wasn't happening, but it certainly was not in the stardom that they hit in the 80s. But yeah, I mean, you know, again, you look back at the songs from these albums, the album covers, just cool in their own right, and just left you with memorable songs. I mean, these are, again, staples of their live show that they did over the last 40 years. And yeah, I mean, just a cool, cool band overall.
Yeah. That Bon Scott stuff is just second to none, just fantastic. And, you know, they're just releasing albums every year, just like all our guys are, you know, back in the day, just every year, one, two albums of just vintage stuff. Geez, you know, just fantastic. Ian, what's your take on AC/DC? Any high points?
Another one of the bands from this entire period that I truly love. The symmetry to the whole thing is a band that we will be touching on next year. Motorhead was lumped into the same type of scenario that AC/DC was. You know, they were being put on bills with the punk bands. They were accepted and loved by the punk bands because they were playing something that didn't sound like what they called the dinosaur rock that was on the radio, you know, your Zeppelins and your Genesis and your Deep Purple and whatever else was going on at the time. But they also you know, flew that moniker saying we're a rock and roll band, not a heavy metal band. But anybody that's anybody can identify that these guys were right there at the roots of what's going to be called heavy metal. And you really, you can't. Another one of the bands that kind of falls into that same trajectory, or at least, you know, for me personally, was the band UFO. UFO put out the album No Heavy Petting that year, following up the album Force It. And really, they continued with a lot of their stuff as well. They had songs like Natural Thing, I'm a Loser, Can You Roll Her, Belladonna, Reasons Love, I mean, I'm with the Action. These are all staple songs that would go on to their upcoming live album. You know, I mean, you're starting to see a trend where, like Walt had pointed out, where all of these bands are trying to capitalize a little bit on some of that popularity they have and exploiting the fact that they're putting on these great shows and not everybody can get out there to see them. So let's go ahead and put this material out live. I've always had made the argument that I could live off from most of these bands, just the live albums, and be completely satisfied. If you had to stick me away on a desert island, give me these live albums and I'm a happy man.
I got to ask you, and this is my take. Is UFO really that big, or are they more of a niche band?
Well, the one thing I think that I may have mentioned to you briefly before was put into context this time period and what other bands of the like were doing and the sound that these guys had. When you listen to songs, especially when you get to the live album, you get to that live album and you hear them in that unadulterated or majority unadulterated recording, you get to hear the tenacity of the guitar work and the drum work and the bass work that's going on with the band. Yes, not every song is the, you know, is for everybody. I have long said that, you know, I could do away with a lot of the more balladeer type material that Phil Mogg likes to sing. But he's another guy that falls right in line with a Paul Rogers and some of those guys at the time, even David Coverdale coming down the road, where they like to spread their wings and bring out that soulful side. That's where they kind of lose me a little bit. But when you listen to, especially just to take you back to 1975, when you listen to the Force It album and it starts off with the song Let It Roll with that just jackhammer, all palm mutes. Nobody was doing it like that at that time. That's the difference.
I'm going to do a little heavy metal homework and I'm going to go and I'm going to listen and I'm going to review. And I'll have my report next week because, honestly, I think the coolest part of that band is Maiden opens up with Dr. Doctor. So not to burst your bubble. Let's see. Walt, Sabbath. Let's stay over in the UK. What's Sabbath up to these days? 76. Are they still a band? Are they in rehab? Are they dead? What's going on?
I think a little bit of all three. You could say. I mean, they released the album Technical Ecstasy in 1976. And again, it's an album met with mixed reviews. It's certainly not horrible, but it doesn't have anything of substance or memory. And I think it was the band trying to sound more modern, and it failed. And I think it's, you know, just think about the writing and the recording, right? I think the band was heavily in the partying mode with drinking and cocaine. They were still chasing the money from, let's say, the executives and the managers ripping them off. And they were at this point where recording an album in Miami around all those temptations. And I think you saw Iommi taking a lead on really the ownership of the band. And I mean, there's some cool songs on there, though. I mean, I love Rock and Roll Doctor. I think just like a cool little rock and roll type song with the cowbell. And I think Dirty Women is also probably maybe the most traditional doomy downtrodden type riff on that album. But, you know, then they started with the ballads. They allowed Bill Ward to sing on a song. And I think those were just kind of mess songs that kind of went nowhere. And then, you know, the tour, you know, Ozzy quit right after the tour, and he was replaced temporarily by a singer named Dave Walker, who came out of the blues band Savoy Brown. And then he came back shortly after that. So if you think about 76, there's not much memory on the band, the touring, maybe the album, a track or two. Probably the biggest thing you find there is that in Europe, AC/DC probably got their big jump start on the road by opening that whole tour. So again, I think this was not the end, but the next album, which comes up in 1978, Never Say Die, is really the nail in the coffin for the band, at least from that iteration of the Ozzy-led band.
And then that's the end. They went down to Miami to record that, and they couldn't stay away from blowing drugs and booze.
What a shock. If you look at some pictures of them from that era, you'll see them on, like, black and white photos of them on speedboats, you know, and dressed in white patent leather shoes and wearing cool sunglasses. I'm like, that is so not what Sabbath should be remembered by.
I would love to go in a time machine and go back to 1975 or 76 and just for a day. All right, well, Walt, another one of your faves, Alice Cooper. What's going on in the Coop camp?
Yeah, another Sabbath-like story here, right? They released the album Go to Hell, and it was a continuation of the concept of the Steven character. But again, just, you know, nothing really memorable in terms of songs that came out of it. Maybe the title track, Go to Hell, was pretty cool. But again, what you saw here is Alice was on his demise. He was drinking heavily. And they actually never got out on the road for the release of this album, which you can imagine at that time, bands were touring 10 out of 12 months. And then they were in the studio for the other two because he had anemia. And the one song that, you know, I think is pretty cool, it's kind of a ballad, and he does throw it into his set list here and there and again now, is the song called I'll Never Cry. And that was actually written by him about his alcoholism. And, you know, shortly after this album, he didn't go on tour, and then he checked into rehab in 1977. So you could kind of, you know, categorize his year of 76 as, wow, a little bit scary and disappointing.
Yeah, well, in the last episode, you pretty much said that Welcome to My Nightmare was Coop's, like, last real good album for a long time. And
yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so, Ian, what do you got with your boys, Queen?
So Queen put out A Day at the Races, and at this point you can see where that pop majesty of what Queen is starts to really come in more and more. Probably the biggest well-known song in the pop fray is Somebody to Love. But they still were putting out some pretty decent hard rockers. The one that is the top of the list would be Tie Your Mother Down. You know, they're still just a great band, and they were so unique, a lot like you had said previously with Rush. You know, I mean, they had a way of kind of melding the hard rock with the progressive. These guys were a little bit more pop friendly, a little bit more balladeerish because of you know, Freddie Mercury's your singer. I mean, he knew how to flex the pipes. But still, it was another solid album. As you start going on these next couple of years, this kind of trend continues until right around the late 70s. And then you can see where they really make a bit more of a deviation away from their sound just a little bit more. All in all, A Day at the Races is still a really good album for that year.
What's the class of 76 debut albums? What's out there?
Well, we touched on, previously, Ted Nugent, you know, having his Free For All album, but you've got that monster of a self-titled album from Boston was probably at the top of the list for everybody. You can't turn on classic rock radio, even some of the hard rock stations on satellite radio without hearing any of the Boston albums. You know, I mean, they were one of those bands that they just struck gold right from the get-go, and it just continued to go for them. Yesterday and today, Dave Menichetti, he finally had gotten things together after slogging it out for a couple of years in the club scenes, and put out the self-titled Yesterday and Today album. They did two albums, as we'll discuss, you know, down the road again, under Yesterday and Today before changing over to YMT officially going forward. The Runaways, they had their self-titled album that year. Another really cool album, kind of gleaning the lines between, you know, glam rock, power pop, and good old-fashioned hard rock and punk, really. Ramones puts out their self-titled album that year. And really, anybody that's a headbanger or into hard rock music understands the importance of Ramones as a band and that first album, that first handful of albums, really, when it comes to this next progression that we're going to be coming across in the next few years. And then Crocus, you know, these guys finally were able to get some things going. So showing a little bit of love for the Swiss there, their self-titled album. Kind of like a lot of the other bands, you know, at that time, a little more, you know, bluesy hard rock, but still had some edge to it. You know, they were kind of one of those anomalies. I think they lucked out for the fact that being so close to Germany with the Scorps and a bunch of other bands around Europe, you know, they kind of were able to take on a different edge. Just to throw real quick on the list, you know, didn't get mentioned last time, but Heart had Dreamboat Annie was released actually in 75 in Canada, but the U.S. release was 76. Crazy on You, Magic Man, you know, these are really cool stuff. That was pretty much the newbies that had kind of rolled around in 76, some new releases, but really some good stuff.
Circling back to Crocus, so it's 76, they're in Switzerland, not exactly the hard rock heavy metal hotbed. Now, this first album, did it have any lasting music that would come out later in their career? You know, like some of these debut albums, they're you know, loaded with vintage songs. I can't recall anything on that first Crocus that followed them through their career.
No, and neither could I. I mean, when I had gone through and did some looking and digging on them, I mean, there wasn't anything that stood out, not to say that they didn't pull, like, you know, the Scorps or Priest with some of these big anniversaries. You know, they actually had one that they, you know, had popped up a couple of years ago. And, you know, they may have pulled some stuff out of the attic for that, but there was really nothing that I could find that stood out on the list that I could recall. I don't think it was until later on where you had albums like Headhunter and stuff like that, where they really started to get, you know, that was when they really were letting themselves be known to the hard rock and metal community that we're accustomed to anyways.
Oh yeah. Headhunter, that was their commercial peak. But even before then, they had the progression, Metal Rendezvous. You know, some of those albums, they had those stepping stone years. But going back to that first Crocus, you know, I've been into Crocus for years, and I never really recall. Ian, what do you know about Boston? Tommy Schultz, you know, we've all heard the stories. He went to MIT. He was a computer electronic whiz. What's the story behind that debut? Because, hey, it's one of the greatest debut albums ever.
The insane part, he recorded everything or just about everything himself in his own studio that he built using his own effects. The Rockman, which is the guitar effect that came out later on in, or was available in the late 70s, early 80s for people to purchase, is actually designed around the larger rack unit that he used, that was his primary sound. You know, everybody's like, oh, he's using a Marshall. No, he used this thing direct for a majority of the recording on that album. So it's really interesting that he was able to get this stuff together and then surround himself with musicians to support the band when they were going to go out and do gigs. He already had this material basically in the can, so to speak, and ready to go, and presented it to them, and then they honed it and brought it to the world.
How did yesterday and today turn into Y&T? Was it a direction change for the band, almost like a rebranding?
I think to hear Dave Menichetti talk about it, and you know, some of the, they don't have, you know, which is a shame, they don't have a big solid documentary like a lot of other bands. But there's, I mean, there's many bands that are like that, but they have several that have been produced by people that were either fans or are in the business. Menichetti at that point, a lot of it was a combination of, I guess, yesterday and today. It really, it came from a Beatles song, and they really weren't, you know, it was just something that kind of was on the front of his mind when they needed a band name, and he pulled that name, but they really weren't in line with that title, with what they were doing. You know, they did the two albums as Yesterday and Today, but by the time they get ready to go to Earthshaker, I mean, that was when I think they decided to, you know, okay, you know, this is the direction we're going. They streamlined it down to Y&T and just, you know, basically went head forward. I mean, because there's really not a lot of difference. Those first couple albums, you can see that natural progression, like a lot of these bands where they were, you know, right from the get-go, they were putting out some solid hard rock, you know, with that metallic sheen to it. You know, they weren't, you know, they've never been a heavy metal band, so to speak, but they've always been one of those heavier hard rock bands like a Van Halen or some of these other acts that we're going to encounter. But I guess the bigger separation with all of their albums is Menichetti always liked to delve into the occasional ballad and then some of those bluesy numbers that he likes to be able to spread his wings on, and his voice. I mean, he's you know, got one of the better voices in rock music.
This year, they did release the first authorized documentary entitled On With The Show. So it chronicles the entire Y&T career, and that's on all streaming services. So we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about who's developing their sound in basements and garages around the world as Metal Mayhem ROC presents the history of metal, the year 1976. Friends of the Metal Mayhem ROC podcast, Vernomatic here, inviting you to get those horns up and to join us live Monday night, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time for Metal Mayhem ROC Live. We crack the vaults open and play the best of the metal for the last 50 years. Get in the chat room, meet other bangers from around the world, send me a request and I'll get it on for you. That's Metal Mayhem ROC Live with me, the Vernomatic, Monday nights, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time on netmetalstation.com.
This edition of Metal Mayhem ROC is brought to you by Mr. V's Street Style Vending and Special Events Catering. Visit our lunch cart in the College Town District at Strong Memorial Hospital. Look us up at mrvsvending.com for catering, pricing, and availability. That's Mr. V's Street Style Vending and Special Events Catering. Now, back to Metal Mayhem ROC.
We're turning the corner on tonight's episode, History of Heavy Metal, the year 1976. Again, we're being joined by Metal Mayhem ROC correspondent Metal Walt from the New York, New Jersey area, and Ian O'Rourke, lead co-guitarist and lead co-singer of the band Motorlord. Ian, 1976, what's going on with some of our repeat offenders and some bands that aren't necessarily the heaviest bands in the world, but are part of this story that we're trying to tell?
1976, we saw a lot of the so-called repeat offenders that we had met along the way continuing to put out some quality albums. Blue Oyster Cult had Agents of Fortune. Agents of Fortune had the big single off. It was Don't Fear the Reaper. You know, you had a band like Styx, first album with Tommy Shaw, Crystal Ball, just on a whole other level when he comes in to help contribute to some of the songwriting. Sweet with Give Us a Wink, still continuing to put out that glam rock, you know, on the heavier side, but they're doing it with that sound and style that they have. You've got Angel with Hell of a Band. Kansas had Left Overture, Carry On My Wayward Son, You know, fantastic album. You've got Bad Company with Running with the Pack, Nazareth, Close Enough for Rock and Roll, and Playing the Game, another band putting out two albums within the same year. Moxie had their second album. And, you know, as we mentioned in the previous episode, you know, these guys are, you know, unless you're somebody that's into the scene and into, you know, Canadian hard rock and stuff like that, you know, they might be a little obscure, but they still were putting out some really cool stuff. And then you had, you know, some other quality bands, you know, like ZZ Top putting out Tejas, Grand Funk Railroad putting out two albums that year. Jeff Beck put out his seminal album Wired, which if you're a guitar player, you know, that's one of those albums that you almost have to own or at least have listened to. Uriah Heep had High and Mighty, which, and again, continues with what they're doing so well. And then Budgie, you know, if I were Britannia, I'd waive the rules. You know, I mean, these guys were, you know, another one of those obscure bands, but still putting out really good product and, you know, just another reflection of how great things were going as we progressed from 1973 onward into 1976 at this point.
I got a couple questions. Now, Bad Company, they were just a radio-friendly machine. What was the lifespan of Bad Company? When did they break up? Were they one of those mid-70, late-70 bad boy bands where they sort of like flamed out?
They say that there's quite a bit that might have happened at around the same time. There was a lot of tension within the band as you get towards, I think it was 79. When John Bonham died, Paul Rodgers had gone on record in their one of their documentaries and talked about how it basically just kind of knocked the legs out from underneath them as well, because number one, they were really close to the band Led Zeppelin. I mean, this was the first band that Zeppelin picked specifically other than them for their swan song label. I know that Paul Rodgers had been known to do some drinking fairly well early on, but I think at this point he had started to really try to control himself. He had always been involved with, I guess, the martial arts, or at least since the early 70s, and he was really kind of keen on having, you know, sound mind and body. So, you know, I think there was just a combination of things that kind of led to their destruction at that point, unfortunately.
Walt, what other favorites or what other high points of 76 do you like?
Yeah, I think again, continuing on the trend of American bands, I think you saw the origins of Foreigner starting in 76. Sort of the history goes there, Mick Jones sort of exited from the Leslie West band, who, again, Leslie West and Mountain were very big around that time, 74, 75, and he was introduced to Lou Gramm, and the rest became history. And again, they were a staple in America for, let's say, the next 10 years after that. Another interesting, let's say, outcome of, we'll call it the Deep Purple Rainbow family is, as you recalled earlier, we talked about Rainbow Rising and the, let's say, the shutdown of the Deep Purple band. But out of that became a very under, let's say, not a very well-known band called Pace Ashton Lord, containing Ian Pace and John Lord from Deep Purple. And I think they put out one release that year, and Bernie Marsden joined in on that group as, let's say, a guitar player, the touring band. And when eventually that went nowhere, he actually took Lord and Pace with him and linked up with David Coverdale, which again was the origins of Whitesnake. So that's that sort of 6 degrees of separation between, you know, Purple, Rainbow, Whitesnake, and so on and so on. So, and I think I'm going to go real deep here for, let's say, the underground metal folks and listeners. One of my favorite artists, Wino, from the Maryland area, the beginning of his first band called The Obsessed started very early. It wasn't called The Obsessed, but they were called Warhorse, and they were formed in 1976 in that Maryland area. And they would kind of toil around those areas for a little while. And eventually, I think within 3 or 4 years, they became The Obsessed officially. So again, these are those cool little things you kind of research and you find them. And they're not necessarily out in the spotlight, but they're definitely little stories to add to the whole mapping of the history of metal.
So another American rocker, Ted Nugent, released the album Free For All, second studio album, you know, released in October 1976. Killer tracks, the title track Free For All, Dog Eat Dog, Together, Street Rats. Now, Nugent, you know, he was that wild man, wild Ted Nugent with that big, huge guitar. Ian, what's that guitar? What is it? A hollow body? What's that thing called he always plays?
That is a hollow body. That is a Gibson Birdland.
Okay, I got to stay in my lane. Ian's the guitarist and the musician of the group. What's it called?
It's a Birdland made by Gibson. So Ted famously talks about having to stuff the sound holes. And if you look at it, it looks like the cutouts on a violin. Those are the sound holes that allow the air to breathe in and out with the vibrations of the music. He had to stuff newspaper in the sound holes because the hollow body guitars with those humbuckers, which are the pickups in them, are so microphonic, they feed back immediately once they're plugged into an amp. When the amplifier is running at high volume, which Ted is famous for running those Birdlands into his Fender amplifiers, the sound, he used to call it that it would howl. And the howling of that guitar was something that he had to tame. So he always wrapped that into the wild man, Ted Nugent, backline, you know, and his whole, you know, mystique and, you know, being a hunter and the call of the wild and all that stuff. It's really pretty cool. And Ted's the one guy that, you know, you have certain guitarists along the way. You know, Rory Gallagher had his Fender Strat and an AC-30. You had Jimmy Page with, you know, he was the epitome of the Marshall stack with the Les Paul, you know, but early on he had the Telecaster with his little Supro amp. And then you had Ted with his Birdland guitar and Fender amplifiers. Every one of them has their own distinct sound, but all of it sounds just amazing.
Yeah, you're right. Nugent, that was a great description. The Call of the Wild, you know, Motor City Madman, Motor City Madhouse. Nugent, again, Nugent was my very first concert, Scream Dream Tour, 1980. And I went with a buddy. I was like 13 years old. And at the time, we didn't know about encores. You know, it was our first concert. So they finish. Me and my buddy were walking out, and all of a sudden we hear the crowd going nuts. We go running back in, and there's Nugent swinging on a vine with a loincloth on. And we're just like, Jesus, Ted Nugent. So, all right.
He truly, truly was and still is pretty much a wild man.
Yeah. When you watch him. You know, politics aside, I'm still a big Nugent fan. Sure. All right, Ian, we're going to wrap this up, but what is going on in basements and garages around the world?
So in 76, you've got some key bands, you know, you're starting to see that bubbling up for the new wave of British heavy metal movement. You've got Angel Witch. You've got a band called Bronze that was around at the time, Ethel the Frog. You had Diamond Head that were coming out. And then, you know, over in Germany, you had their counterparts in Accept were getting going. In the States, you had Pat Travers Band. Mickey Rat, which ended up becoming Rat, got their start. The Obsessed down in Maryland, you know, you can't talk about doom metal, you know, without talking about Wino and the Obsessed. You've got a little band called Sister in California that actually had members of both Motley Crue and Wasp in the band. This is pre-London. So Nikki Six and Blackie Lawless were in the band together. Don Dokken had his band Airborne, and which was pre-Dokken. And then you had little bands like U2 and The Clash were getting started over in the UK as well. So there's a lot of good stuff that's getting ready to come down the road.
Oh, yeah. You know, some say it's, you know, we're about to have an eruption. So, all right. So that's the year 1976. Ian, thanks again for your input. Great job. And I will check in with you and Metal Walt next week.
All right, man.
I'm the Vertimatic. This is Metal Mayhem ROC, the year 1976, the history of metal. Talk to you next week, folks.
Metal for Life.
Thanks for listening to Metal Mayhem ROC. Check out our websites at metalmayhemroc.com and metalforever.com for information on upcoming concerts, podcasts, archives, and all sorts of info. Please like, follow, and share with everyone,
even your non-metal friends.
Catch us next time on WLFE-DB Radio.